Welcome to lesson 19. Today we're going to go, first of all, right into dealing with some protocols. I didn't get to this in lesson 18, so we put it on the beginning of this one, and then we'll quickly take a walk in some diplomats' shoes. Now, protocols at the United Nations. It's good to know them, but you don't have to conform. Some of the rules of etiquette are far more important than others. But I do want to make sure that you understand what they are. When you understand what the norm and expected standards are, then you can strategically choose to differ from them if you want to produce a particular or different effect. If, on the other hand, you want to fit in and go with the flow and be under the radar on certain issues as you communicate with diplomats and those in the United Nations, then you will know how to do that as well. So again, this is information that gives you additional choices in the kinds of impact that you can have on individuals and or larger groups of people at the United Nations. Now, of course, one of the most obvious places where protocols come into play is in the greetings. And putting it very simply, especially when you're dealing with an ambassador, it is best to know their name. But you can't always know their name. Sometimes you only can see that they're the person getting out of a car with diplomatic plates that has a 001 on it. And in that case, the chances are that they are the head of the mission, possibly, most likely, the ambassador, but not always. Now, if you're wanting to approach the ambassador in this situation, or the person that perhaps you think is an ambassador, this is the time to use what I call the Secretary General's upgrade. Now, everyone likes to be upgraded, whether it's in a plane or acknowledged to be at a higher level than they perhaps are in anything, rather than to be downgraded or underplayed or underestimated. So in the situation, whomever is getting out of the car, if you at least acknowledge them as the highest level that you can, and that would be as an ambassador, you could at least greet him as Mr. Ambassador or Madam Ambassador. Now, the Secretary General's upgrade, as I called it, goes something like this, and it's best probably illustrated by a story. I'll try to tell it very quickly so we don't get too far off track here. But a number of years ago, when Kofi Annan was still the Secretary General of the United Nations, I was invited by the Ambassador of Ghana, who was a friend of mine at the time, to the annual celebration of Ghanaian independence. Event was going to be held not all that far from where we lived, so that particular time I invited my husband to come along, and he was delighted to join me. So we went, and, you know, coming in, greeted the ambassador and many other people there that I knew, a number of other ambassadors there, etc. By this time, the Secretary General had joined the group, being Ghanaian himself. Then, after a little while, it was time for us to leave. So, with an eye on where he was and what his movements were, you know, it's always interesting to be able to greet the Secretary General, etc. So, of course, I positioned ourselves in a place where the Secretary General would have to go right by us in order to leave, as it appeared that that was what his plans were based on his movements. We were in this good position, and he was coming by. Walking by, of course, everybody's pressing the flesh, and so he greeted my husband, shook his hand, looked him in the eye, and said, "Good evening, Mr. Ambassador." Well, that story has been told many times by my husband. He thoroughly enjoyed being called Mr. Ambassador by the Secretary General of the United Nations. It sure made him feel good. Now, Kofi Annan could have said at that time anything, just good evening. But instead, he spoke to them as the highest possible position that he could use in that context. Don't underestimate the goodwill that that engendered. Those four words, "Good evening, Mr. Ambassador," will be remembered for the rest of my husband's life, I'm certain. All that is to say is, if in fact you're wanting to keep on good terms with those that you are greeting, when in doubt, always greet up. Always acknowledge the person at the highest possible position that they might be. If in doubt, greet up to the highest level that you can greet them at in the circumstances. If they correct you, that's fine. If they don't correct you, that is also fine. But if in fact you have acknowledged them above their pay grade, so to speak, then they will not think ill of you. They will remember you well. Now, of course, if I was to go thoroughly into all dimensions of greetings at the United Nations, it could take up a whole lesson or a couple of lessons in and of itself, and that's not what I'm here to do. So I just want to make three main points here as we deal with protocols. First of all, it's kind of like the obvious, be courteous. And a lot of what that really means is that you need to be aware that in fact protocol in the United Nations, it has an awful lot to do with positioning. And in this context, it really is the ranking of officials. And to remember that the United Nations is effectively their house. It's their place. It was set up for government officials. And their ranking and their positioning is, to some of them, it's of extreme importance. To others, it really doesn't matter that much. Their value is not tied up in their rank. But some are. And sometimes you still need to work well with those people. So you cannot afford, in many instances, to underestimate the impact on some people that ranking them and appropriately responding to them in that rank is critical. So that leads to the third one, the first being be courteous. The second one is be aware, and that part of it is aware of positioning according to rank. And the third one is, when at all in doubt, let the diplomat take the lead, especially as it pertains to gestures, handshakes, cheek to cheek, hands on heart, whatever it might be. Take your lead from the diplomat. Greetings and cultural nuances are very important. Next to written communications. Written communications are key for the United Nations. I think that's already become quite apparent through our discussions on resolutions. What tracks the nature of the relationship, the history of the relationship, what gives a reference point for clarity, are written documents. And these are very important. Now, I have this UN Communications Handbook. Very few NGOs are even aware of it. It's actually a guide to the drafting, processing, and dispatch of official United Nations communications. Now, of course, as NGOs, we don't need to be connecting at a very official level because we're not part of the UN system. However, it's very good for you to understand what is considered the basic expected form of formal communications. By looking at that, and I've got the link here and below, and part of the homework this time will be to go through this for you to look at it and to see. It's completely up to you to decide how you're going to use that information. But again, what we are doing here is providing you with that information. Virtually secret information in this case. This really is quite a find that I'm providing for you. Then there are protocols between the United Nations and the member states and the missions. This is more easily available, and it can be found online at this location. And again, I want you, as part of your homework, to read through it, because this gives you an idea of the kinds of work that the missions are expected to do, especially in relation to the times when, for example, during the high-level debate of the General Assembly, the annual session in September, there are a lot of details that need to be taken care of when either the head of state comes in or the senior ministers from the country come in to participate, and there are many details that need to be communicated and organized by the missions. In the larger missions, again, you've got departments that will take care of this and individuals who are assigned to that. In the smaller missions, you need to understand that this is the kind of work that even sometimes the ambassadors themselves have to do and take care of. Why is this important? It's important because you need to know that leading up to the General Assembly, if you're wanting to get the time of an ambassador, you need to know how precious their time is, what they've got on their plate. And a no from an ambassador at that time may not mean no, they're not interested, they're unwilling to be helpful or useful, that they want you out of their life. It just may simply mean no, I just can't even think left or right from the pressing issues that I have because I have to take care of my president, prime minister, or senior ministers who are coming into town next week or the week after, and I've got so many things that I still need to do, I can't even imagine taking time out. This kind of information enhances your understanding of what is going on in the minds of the diplomats and the people that you are approaching at the United Nations. In this manual of protocol, it also has a list of senior officials of the United Nations. Again, this is good information for you. Look through that list. It helps you understand rankings in the UN system. So look through it and give yourself this kind of background information. It also provides you the lists of heads of state. And of course, it's only as current as that information that has been provided by either the nations or the missions to the United Nations from that particular country. This is another valuable resource. Whether you're seeking to get a meeting with the head of state when they come to town for the General Assembly, or perhaps more likely referring to them in some kind of correspondence with the mission, it's really important to get the exact name of the current head of state and all the spelling perfectly accurate. It's very easy to get any of these details wrong, but it's so important to pay attention to these details. And this reference can save you from embarrassment and help you really get it right. You don't want those reading the letter, whether it be the ambassador or a representative of the mission, getting stuck on the fact that you don't even know how to spell their head of state's name. How do you feel when you see your own name written incorrectly? You always notice. It always catches you. It may not be the end of the world as far as what you end up thinking about that person, but it certainly indicates that that person isn't all that interested in you, really, if they don't take the time to get your name correct. So use this kind of information in any of your correspondence. Use these resources. They are important. Your main homework for today will be to go through these, to look at them, to know where they are, to download them and get them onto your computer, and to start to familiarize yourself with the content and material. If nothing else, it's interesting. Now we're going to go into the facets of a diplomat's life. And this is the part when we begin to start to walk in their shoes a little bit more. By considering the many variables that impact any one diplomat, it will help us better understand what is pulling, tugging, influencing them, even though they stand right in front of us, perhaps with a very pleasant smile on their face and engaging us very kindly. But we do need to know or have some sense of the many dimensions that we are actually engaging when we speak to a diplomat. There are the personal, that is, the family, what's going on with the family, whether they're there, whether they're back in their home country, and the dynamics within the family. There are the natural capacities of the individual diplomat, their past experiences, and so on. Whether they're a career diplomat or political assignee, it not only influences their you know, their immediate experiences, but also it can impact how they go about doing their work. Taking a rather extreme example of a political assignee from a country in political turmoil, that person will realize they have very little time to do anything. Depending on the circumstances of the turmoil, they may feel like they have very little capacity to move and act or make any significant headway at the UN. On the other hand, some people, according to the mix of natural capacities and external situations, may take that as a prime opportunity to get in there and really do something significant while they are there. Again, just so many variables. The status and the priorities of their country is a major influence in what they will do and how they will go about doing their work, what they will be thinking and what their priorities are. Again, stability or instability, developed or developing, a country that has a focus on security or on development issues or on criminal justice issues varies and influences incredibly the work that will get done and the focus of the ambassador at the United Nations. And in fact, not just the ambassador, but the whole mission that the ambassador has to coordinate and oversee. And of course, whether that individual is there with the full support of their country to make decisions or whether they're really just a PR mouthpiece for that country, it varies. The full range of possibilities you can find are somewhere at play in the United Nations. And of course, the time frame that each diplomat has or knows that they have to do their work. Sometimes it's just a matter of diplomats are cycled through the United Nations every 2 or 3 years. Some are there for years. Perhaps in some instances it may be because it's very difficult to get other people with that kind of experience from their country. So rather than keep changing people, they will keep one person assigned for quite some time. These are the angles that you can consider as you approach a diplomat and look at them and ponder why they are doing things or who might be a good person to deal with. These are factors that you would do well to consider. We're taking the time to look into each of these little nooks and crannies of a diplomat's life so that you can better get into their mind. You are then better equipped to speak to this person in an influential way. You'll understand what they value. You'll understand what they're concerned about. You'll understand better their hopes, aspirations, and maybe even the things that they're concerned about or they fear or that are of unsettling concern. So I think you can see that there are just many factors that are impacting diplomats. And I'm going to run through a few more of these that diplomats need to find a place for in their thinking and therefore in their judgments and their strategies. You've got the background of what the UN is, what it can do, what it cannot do, how it is shifting and changing as a global institution in a globalizing world, what their country wants them to accomplish, what the country's agenda is at the United Nations, what is going on in their capital, what specifically that capital has mandated to the diplomatic mission at the United Nations beyond just what is the work of the United Nations, that can be a factor. You will also need to understand the limits and the possibilities that diplomacy offers. It cannot do everything. It does not provide, it's not a panacea for all strife and problems in the world. It has its role and it can accomplish certain things and there are many things it cannot. And there are the individual limitations and possibilities grounded in the very character and personality of the individual and in factors such as whether or not this person is a political appointee or a career diplomat. This is, in effect, a little summary, a little map of the lay of the diplomatic lands. It's clear to say that the mission or an ambassador cannot take up every good cause that they would like to, even on a personal level, because they have their priorities, their tasks, and their responsibilities. However, when they see something that dovetails and can help save them time, energy, and effort, as you can see, their time is very precious. It can easily be taken up by all of the work that they have before them at the United Nations. So when something can help them get their job done, shorter, quicker, faster, better, they will be interested. And this is why you need to understand their history, their mission's focus, what they are interested in. You've got to find those countries, those ambassadors, those people who are seriously interested in your area of work. It's not just a matter of you having an issue that everybody should be interested in. Well, yes, maybe they should be, and they could be, if they had time, if they had the resources, the human resources, the financial resources, but they don't always. So part of what your work is, and top priority for your work, is to position your NGO and what it does and accomplishes as something that can save them time, money, and effort, and is something that they still really need to get done. And this is not a matter of doing something different within your organization, as much as it is how you position yourself and present your organization to those missions or departments of the United Nations that are very appropriate for your work. So a super important part of your work is to research sufficiently to find out who are those missions and individuals that really can benefit from what you have. Then they will give you the time of day. Then you can find ways to work with them and get them to become your strong allies. And then you can do amazing things at the United Nations. You need to know also who they work with, and research, research, research. By knowing who their allies are, especially on a particular topic, that then becomes a way for you to find that small network of people that are interested in the area of your concern, that then are those people that you can work with. So you can find a little gold mine of people. Once you find one, you do the research, you find the one who can really be good, then you find out who they work with. You go and you find out, using the UN documentation, how to find out who those other missions and individuals in the missions, ideally then you have to find, you find the person, you ask who they work with, then you can go and tap them as well. Research, research, research. It can be very exciting. You can find the people who are actively interested in your area, tasked with by their nation to work in that area, then you know you've got a great way to approach them. Because you can approach them by saying, even if you don't know what we're doing yet, you need to know because this is your area of work. You know, you can say it nicely. But the point is you can go in with authority, knowing that they are being tasked, if you've done your research, knowing that they've been tasked with that responsibility, you can press them to take the time, to make the time. You have to do the work to prepare it so that it's ready for them to see very quickly, very succinctly, how important your work and information and resources are to them. I hope that through all of this I've been able to show to you that diplomats have a very, very, very full life. The work of the NGOs is to present your work, your projects, your programs, your information, your resources, your programs in their country into something that they can very quickly see is in fact a solution to something that they are working on and have to deal with, without them having to do the translating of what this means to them. That's our work, to do that kind of quote-unquote translation into information that is useful and easily accessible by a diplomat.
I did have another couple of slides, but the time is gone already, and I don't want to extend this lesson any further, so let's wrap it up here. However, I do want you to go to those two PDF documents. The links are right below. And look through them. You don't have to remember everything. You don't have to know all the details. But know essentially what is in them so that when you need to know that information, you know where to go to look for it. Plus, you will also have a much better idea of understanding the diplomats from the perspective of protocols, what's expected of them, and what they expect in their diplomatic environment. This way, again, it gives you just that extra bit of knowledge, information, and background that will help strengthen your capacity to walk into their world and to influence it. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow for the 20th lesson. Rest well and enjoy the rest of your day.